We're going to be starting a series in the book of Ruth. And if you're not sure where Ruth is, it's in the Old Testament. It's about the eighth book in. So it comes after Joshua, Judges, Ruth, before the Samuels and the Kings and the Chronicles. So if you've got a Bible, get it open. In a moment, we're going to hear it read to us. Recently, we had a leaflet in our mailbox which was entitled, "The Most Thoughtful Decision You Can Ever Make." So I don't know what you think the most thoughtful decision you can ever make is. Lots of different options come to mind. The one this leaflet recommended is prepaid funerals. So there's a happy thought for you. So prepaid funerals, and apparently that's the most thoughtful thing you could do for your relatives and your friends and your loved ones. Well, in some ways, they're right and they're wrong. They're completely wrong, because I don't think it is the most important decision, but they're right in that it does, the most important decision relates to death. But the issue there is about not the body, it's the soul. What's going to happen to you after you die? What are the decisions you're going to make in your life that will affect that? And the book of Ruth is a wonderful book in the Bible. If you've not had a chance to read it, I would suggest you have a look at it sometime over the coming weeks, because we're going to be studying it when I'm preaching over the next month or so. And I find it a beautiful story. It's full of charm. Just as a kind of piece of literature, it's got tremendous value. It's a very engaging story. But it's full of charm and insight and fascination as we study these lives of these men and women, primarily women. The women are the heroes, the heroines of the story. And but these people who are very ordinary, very down-to-earth, hidden lives, and yet they speak powerful truths for all of us, which we can all take away and live out in our own lives today. And so I think there's much of the stuff from Ruth which resonates down the ages, and which, as we look at it today and in the days ahead, hopefully you'll find lots of take away and to be encouraged for in your own life and your walk with God. Because it's about real people in real lives making real choices. And that's all of us in our lives. So we're going to have this read to us. Anna's going to come and read. So we're going to read all of Ruth chapter 1. And I think it's going to be on the screens as well.
In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Paphrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the woman exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Lord Jesus, we do just come before you and thank you for your presence. We ask that your word would penetrate our hearts, and we thank you that your word is alive and active, and that it's a plumb line that we can gauge our whole lives by. Thank you for Alex, and just anoint him as he preaches today. And Father, would you fill us afresh with more of you today? In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you. Okay, be good to keep your Bibles open as we look at this together and go through from here. So Ruth begins with a little phrase, and the phrase is, "In the days when the judges ruled." Now, we don't necessarily understand that, but the original hearers of the story of Ruth would have heard a lot from that. The days of the judges was roughly 1200 BC through to about 1020 BC. With the dates you get in this book, roughly, this story is taking place in about the year 1108 BC. So, 3,100 years ago, this story happened, more or less. So, it's an old story. Happened a long time ago. The Judges is an era which is recorded very cunningly in a book called The Book of Judges. Ah, yes, we have deep theology here. And the Book of Judges tells the story of the people of Israel and how they go through these cycles. And what happens is they're doing well, they're blessed, God gives them good stuff in their life, and they start to forget about God and turn away from him and start worshipping other false gods, small g gods, that are from the native peoples that they've taken over the land of Israel from. And so they turn from God, and so God allows other nations to come in and oppress them and rule over them until they come to their senses and they repent and they call upon the Lord. And what God does then is he raises up what's called a judge, a leader, someone who can lead the people back to spiritual wholeheartedness and following God and out of release from the oppression of the enemy, which has happened in their lives. Don't forget, one of the rules of reading the Old Testament is that things that happen physically in the Old Testament often happen spiritually for us post the New Testament. So there they're experiencing physical oppression from the enemy, and often for us, as we turn from God, we experience spiritual oppression from the enemy. It comes in different forms. Our land isn't invaded, but our hearts and our lives can be. And so God raises up a judge, and it's not, we think of judge as something like Judge Judy on television, and it's not that at all. Judge here is not a legal role so much as a spiritual role, and really, one translation actually calls them heroes. You could think of them as spiritual heroes and heroines who God raises up to rescue his people. But these judges do have limits. They aren't perfect. We see some of them like Samson, who are very flawed characters, and they only live for so long, they have a certain lifespan, and then the process goes back in again. And so what you see in the book of Judges, the era of the judges, is this. It's the importance of wise decision-making. The importance of wise decision-making. And it's the impact that our decisions have upon individuals and also upon communities, upon whole nations at times. Now, decision-making is something which we all wrestle with. You will know, I'm sure the sociologists tell us that the amount of decision-making we have to do in this generation is far greater than our parents' generation, far greater than their generation before that. We live in a culture which is moving at hyper-fast speed, and there's billions of decisions we have to make all through our life. And it can feel like too much choice. I was reminded of a story about a British Prime Minister from 1908 to 1916 called Herbert Asquith. There's a name to conjure with. I love English names. Herbert Asquith. And he was spending the weekend at an estate of the Rothschild family, in a place called Wadston. And it was a very opulent, wealthy, massive English country estate, just before the First World War, while those things were still in their heyday. And they gather for tea. You have to remember, of course, this is England. Tea is like the ritual. Okay, so it's a very serious affair. If you go to England, you've got to do it. You know, that's the one thing you must do. Have proper tea time somewhere. And you'd be pleased to know the staff here at Bridgeway are being trained by me. And we have many varieties of tea on offer in the staff room. It's wonderful. The Lord is moving. The Spirit is strong. And the coffee demon has been gradually evicted. So anyway, it's tea time in this great estate, servants waiting around, and the Prime Minister sits down, and the butler comes up to him, and the following conversation follows. The butler says, "Tea, coffee, or peach off the wall, sir?" What a wonderful expression. I mean, like, they're just showing off, basically, because you can't grow peaches in England, it's far too cold. And it was like, we've got a posh greenhouse where we can grow that stuff. So he says, "Tea, coffee, or a peach off the wall, sir?" "Tea, please," answers Asquith. "China, India, or Ceylon?" asked the butler. "China, please." "Lemon, milk, or cream, sir?" He goes, "Milk, please." "Jersey, Hereford, or Shorthorn, sir?" And it's like this kind of overwhelming decision of choice. The opulence they lived in, they could even offer you different varieties of milk according to the different cows that you like to drink it from. And we have this overwhelming level of choice facing us, and we go out and we make decisions. Hannah sent me to this shopping yesterday, to the supermarket, and one of the things on the list is bread. Well, I remember bread, the choice of bread used to be white bread, brown bread, or posh wholemeal bread. There was like three choices. You go to the supermarket now, there's about 9 million types of bread to choose from. It's an overwhelming choice. It takes about 15 minutes to select the right one. So we have choice. Now, that's silly stuff, but of course, we face choices and decisions about all sorts of more serious things in our lives. And how do we start to navigate? What's our compass? How do we get our bearings? And at the time of Judges, many people were making bad choices and bad decisions. If you just flick your eye back to the very end of Judges, which is right before Ruth, and Judges ends with this verse, Judges 21, verse 25. "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." And actually, that's a refrain that goes through the book of Judges. It's said about three or four times. Everyone did as he or she saw fit. Reminds me of the saying that we make our decisions, and then our decisions turn around and make us. The book of Judges and the book of Ruth are very closely linked. They're not only next to each other. In fact, for about the first 1,000 years of their existence, Jews would number them as one book. They weren't actually regarded as separate books of the Bible. Judges gives us this big picture narrative. You see the impact of the community, decisions made by the wider community as a whole upon individuals. The book of Ruth is a personal narrative. And you see there the impact of individual decisions upon the wider community. Ruth is a book that deals with unimportant people doing very unimportant matters. And yet, we see God is active in their lives. And we can take the lesson that God is active in our affairs and in our lives. And he works his purposes out, and he blesses those who will trust him. And we'll see that pattern in this book. In other words, those who put God first and others second and themselves third, God will powerfully bless. So let's dig in a bit more to some of the stuff that goes on here in this first chapter. The first thing I want to point out to you is some of the meanings of the names that are in there. Because names are very important to Hebrew-minded people. So this is written in Hebrew, don't forget. And to the Jews, the meaning of your name is very important. You weren't just given a random name when you were born. And what would happen is your name would reflect either your parents' hopes for your future, or it would reflect the situation at your birth, either for you personally or for your community or your country at that time. So just before I expose the names, turn to someone sitting by and tell them what your name means and why you were given it, if you know. If you don't know, just say, I had no idea. You might have to say it in case you don't know them. Okay, we have some names here. So there's some names here in this passage. We have, first of all, the first character we're introduced to is a man. His name is Elimelech. That literally means God is king. That's a good name to have. God is king. Like that name. He marries Naomi, and her name means pleasant one. Anyone called Naomi here? We've got any Naomi, isn't it? Great. Got a Naomi. Pleasant one. So very good. That's a lovely meaning. They have two children. They have interesting names. Mahlon means weakness, and Kilion means failing or annihilation. You could maybe guess that they're melancholics as the parents, I don't know, but probably it reflects about these were sickly boys, sickly at the time of their birth. But arguably, of course, it reflects the fact that the nation was spiritually sick at the time of their birth as well. And then this famine comes down and it causes them to leave Bethlehem. And again, we don't quite get what's going on here. Bethlehem literally means house of bread. So what we're told here is that there is no bread in the house of bread. And so they go off, trotting off to Moab. And that was a very interesting decision for Elimelech, God is king, to make. Because Moab is the enemy of Israel. They worship Chemosh, which is their particular god. And in the cultures of that time, ancient Near Eastern cultures, gods were viewed as very territorial. Now, I'm not saying this is correct, but this is just how they would have thought. So they saw God as operating in a particular geographic space. Thus, when several hundred years later, Elisha is used to heal Naaman, who's the Syrian army chief. Naaman's cleansed of leprosy. He wants to honor God. He's going back to his land. So he takes two donkey loads of Israelite soil back, pardon me, to Syria, so that he can then settle there and worship God in that place. Because their mindset was it was a land-based thing. That's how you did worship. Now, I'm not saying that's correct, but it's an interesting insight. Because for Elimelech then to go to a foreign country where they worship Chemosh, he seems to have forgotten the meaning of his name. God is king. Because he's not going as a missionary. And so they leave the fields of Bethlehem, they go down the Kidron Valley, they go through the wilderness of Judea, around the northern edge of the Dead Sea, up through the Arnon Valley, to the very edge of the desert, where Moab is. And there Elimelech dies. And the boys marry a couple of Moabite girls. There's no nice Jewish girls for them to marry there. So they have to marry some local girls, which is not forbidden for Jews to do. But again, it wasn't an obviously wise decision if you wanted your grandchildren to be followers of God. And then the sons die. The story's going downhill rapidly, isn't it? And Naomi's left, widowed. She's lost her sons. She's an alien. She has no wealth, no assets. And we're meant to draw out of that, the original readers would have drawn out of that, a spiritual significance. In fact, the Talmud, which is an ancient Jewish commentary on the Old Testament, actually notes at this point that this was a punishment from God for their leaving Israel. Now, whether you think that's correct or not, we can talk about. But it's an interesting perspective there, that what one thing's original hearers of the story would have heard, with all that death and loss, is that God's judging them for having turned their backs upon him. And Naomi, if you imagine her situation, she's incredibly vulnerable at this point. There's no social security, there's no public welfare, there's no community around her to support her. She's lost everything. And yet, in the midst of this darkness, a little crack of light appears. In verse 6, we're told that she hears God has provided food. Literally, the word is bread, interestingly, to his people. It says that she hears that the Lord had come to the aid of his people. And that little phrase, come to the aid of, is better translated, visit. And what that means in Hebrew is that God has come and visited his people in blessing after a time of trial. It's a very specific word. So it means God visiting his people in blessing after a time of trial. Naomi hears this and she thinks, well, maybe God can come and visit me after my time of trial. There's a glimmer of hope for her in this situation. And you imagine, she's had three heart-rending funerals. She's got no men to protect her from the disasters of widowhood. And as miserable as her life in Bethlehem is going to be, I mean, imagine what she's going back to. All those memories, if nothing else, of her childhood, of the place she was courted by Elimelech, the place of their first kiss, the place where her boys were born, where they first walked. She's going back to that very small, same place. Nevertheless, it's easier for her to go back there than to stay in Moab. And of course, for her, it is a going home. And I think one of the things we're meant to see in that is this, that we may make decisions which take us out of God's will for our lives. Decisions which are flawed and cause a mess and consequences for us. But even when we've taken decisions that take us out of God's will, we are never out of his reach. God is always able to reach us and bring change and bring hope and bring that ray of light. Paul wrote this to Timothy 1,000 years later. If we are faithless, God will remain faithful, for he cannot disown himself. So Naomi sets out with her faithful daughters-in-law. And again, just to help you understand this, in those days, when you married, as a woman, when you married a man, you were then part of that man's family forevermore, even after he died. So you changed families forever. And so, of course, the daughters-in-law expected to go with Naomi on this journey. And that would have been important for Naomi because these daughters-in-law represent for her her only hope of earning money, both them going out to work and potentially them being young enough still to find another man to marry and receiving support from that wider family they would marry into. And so they set out together. And then as they're walking along this road, Naomi stops in her tracks. And she looks at them and she does an amazing act of generosity. And she releases them from their commitment to her. She says, look, you can't come and be aliens in a foreign country. I've done that. I know how hard that is. I'm releasing you. Go back to your own land. Go back to your family, to your mother's family. Go back to your God, Chemosh. Go back to your people. I'm releasing you. And she says to them this, may the Lord show kindness to you. And again, the English is kind of weak there. Really, the word means for kindness means a deep loving kindness, a steadfast love, a truly loyal attitude. And what that is a covenant word. It's a covenant word. In other words, they may go back to Moab and to Chemosh, that their God, but Naomi's praying a blessing upon them, the blessing of the covenant-honouring God onto these girls who have been so faithful to her and to her family. Well, Orpah and Ruth, the two daughters-in-law, insist that they want to stay with Naomi. Now, of course, how much of that at this point is genuine and how much is just kind of the cultural expectation, I don't know. You know the thing where, like, you go out for a meal with someone and it's like someone says, oh, I'll pay. And you go, no, 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 I'll pay. And they go, no, 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 I'll pay. No, 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 I'll pay. You have that little debate. You know that little game we all play when you go out? Yeah, you remember that? You guys play that, surely. I mean, you're all Christians. I mean, we all have to do that. It's like... Okay, here's a question for you. What's the slowest thing on four legs? Okay, the answer is... Two Christians in the doorway. Well done. No, no, after you, brother. No, no, sister, you go first. Okay, very good, Jake. Well done. Love it. So, Orpah and Ruth are doing a bit of this. How much is genuine? I think there's probably a mixture of stuff going on here. And what's interesting is, again, just to help you understand it, Naomi does this speech about you can't wait for me to have more kids and all the rest of it. Well, what that's about is this. Under Jewish law, and they'd married into a Jewish household, any future sons of Naomi were obliged to marry any widows of their brothers. So if she had sons, such as, and when they've grown up, they would be obliged to marry these girls before they could marry anyone else. That's how it worked. So that's just the cultural norm at that time. And yet Naomi says, look, that's a nonsense plan. You know, I'm probably too old to have any more kids. I haven't got a husband. And are you really going to wait around for umpteen years to see that happen? And so Orpah listens to this. She's convinced by the argument, and she does that farewell kiss and says goodbye, and she leaves. And Naomi urges Ruth to follow suit. Ruth is still there. And she says, look, go back to your original people, Moab. Go back to your original god, Chemosh. And Ruth, we're told in verse 14, clings to her. I think Anna read it really well. She says she clung to Naomi. And that word clung literally is cleave. And cleave is the word that's used of how Adam and Eve came together in Genesis 2. Now, of course, clearly this doesn't mean sexually coming together, but what it means is it's a covenant coming together. Don't forget, covenant means everything I am, I give to you. Everything you are, you give to me. It's a sharing of everything. Two become one, and you are united. And that's what Ruth is doing here in response to Naomi. And what we see in Ruth is this. We see a determination. We see passion-filled words that flow across her lips. In a moment, we're going to see them. That, I think, they flow out from the very core of her being, the centre of her identity, who she is. And what we see as Ruth is a woman of immense resourcefulness and humility. A woman of character and charm. A woman of strength and of grace. I mean, she's a beguiling character. She'd be a wonderful person to be around. Sort of person we should have on our top 10 list to meet in heaven. If you're a parent and you have daughters, I would say Ruth is a great book to point them towards, a great woman to give you a little role model. If you're a woman here today, you're thinking, where do I get a model of a woman of God? Well, Ruth is a good place to start. Because she has these attributes just marvellously mixed up. And so, verses 16 and 17, let me read them to you again, because these are like the hinge upon which this whole book turns. Ruth says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. These are phrases of great beauty and power. As I read them through again, they reminded me of marriage vows. I don't know if they sound like that to you. And you see all sorts of things here. You see a declaration of profound loyalty to Naomi. You see Ruth identifying herself fully with Naomi's people, Israel. And that reminds us that we live in community, we don't live individually. You see a devotion to Naomi's God, who clearly at some point has become Ruth's God. She's been with this family, and she's seen something about the way they live, the way they operate, the way they've come through these trials, the way Naomi has kept hold of her faith in God, even after having been hammered to all these circumstances of life. And Ruth sees that, and there's something in her which she says, that's what I want to be like. I'm going to follow this God. And now she's acknowledging this externally. She makes a permanent commitment. Literally, I'm reminded of the phrase, the marriage vows, till death us do part. And in ancient cultures, there was a strong importance placed upon your place of burial. And even in death, Ruth is saying, she won't be parted from Naomi. And then finally, she does this oath which seals the promise. It invokes God, her God's judgment, if she breaks this vow. And again, the Hebrew isn't quite translated very clearly here, just because you can't. The Hebrew word actually implies, she says, if I don't do this, may God judge me. And the word for judge is really a sense of, it's a sound and it's an action. It's a bit like us going, you know, finger across your throat. If I'm not honest, you know, you can get me, God. It's kind of like that sense. It's a real kind of blood-curdling commitment she's making here. I'm in this wholeheartedly, and God is my witness. That's what she's saying. And there is a massive level of commitment to God that Ruth is taking on here, to Naomi and to Naomi's people. This is genuine covenant love in action. It's not some flowery, soppy thing. It's just a passing fad. This is a permanent thing. It's full-blooded, totally embracing, all-conquering, a heroic commitment. It's the sort of commitment that can turn the world upside down, and it's the sort of commitment that we're challenged to have as we walk with God. I read a story this week as I was just preparing this about Alexander the Great, who's obviously got a great name, and He conquered, as you know, almost all of the known world at that time as he set out from Greece with his military strength and cleverness and diplomacy. Well, one day, Alexander, just a small company of his soldiers, came upon a strongly defended walled city. So Alexander stands outside the city, raises his voice and demands to speak to the king, who eventually comes to the battlements and listens to Alexander's demands. "Surrender to me immediately," demanded Alexander. The king laughs. He said, "Why should I surrender to you? There's not many of you. We're in our walled city. We can outfight you. You're no threat to us." Alexander then says this: "Allow me to demonstrate why you should surrender." Alexander ordered his men to line up in single file, and he started marching them. He marched them straight towards a sheer cliff that dropped hundreds of feet to the rocks below. The king and his soldiers defending the city watched in shocked disbelief as one by one, Alexander's soldiers marched without hesitation right off the cliff to their deaths. After 10 soldiers had died, Alexander ordered the rest of his men to stop and to return to his side. And the king and the defending city surrendered on the spot. Now, I'm not saying we should line up our Sunday school, march them off a cliff. Tempting at times, I know, if you're a parent. But what happened here is this. The king and his advisors realised that nothing was going to stop a determined force like that from eventually having the victory. And the question for us is, are we going to be that determined, that disciplined, that willing to self-sacrifice as members of God's army to follow him so that his name and his kingdom get the ultimate victory? So they return to Bethlehem. Not an easy thing in itself. Dangerous land to be crossing. They've gone between nations, two vulnerable women alone, with some few supplies, and that's it. And so they arrive in Bethlehem. You have this wonderful little phrase here. It says, "The whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, 'Can this be Naomi?'" I mean, you can imagine, everyone's going nuts. I mean, the gossip and everything, it's just like, wow, this is incredible. And the women explain, "Can this be Naomi?" Which is an interesting question. I was thinking about this. I think it's like this. Have you ever seen someone after a long absence, perhaps of many years, and they've really changed lots, and you kind of go, "Is that you? Gosh." Have you ever had that experience? I had that experience a few years ago. When we were growing up, there was a family who lived next door to us who had some lads my age, and the parents were called Mr. and Mrs. Philp, and they were very, very formal. You think I'm English, they were super English. Lovely people, but incredibly formal and straight and correct, and everything was neat and tidy and done correctly and properly. You know, you would never, in a month of Sundays, dream of calling them by their first names. I mean, it just would just not happen. And it was very kind of sober and serious lifestyle, and the kids were, you know, super high control, all that stuff. And I hadn't seen them for about 7-8 years, and this is now I'm like in my early 30s, and we're back home, and I happened to bump into them, or bumped into her, and she came out and said, "Oh," she said, "Alex, how are you?" And I looked at her, and she said, I said, "Oh, hello, Mrs. Philp." I can't call her Sue, because obviously that's far too improper. I said, "Hello, Mrs. Philp, nice to see you." And she goes, "Oh," she says, "you haven't changed at all." And I looked at her and thought, well, I honestly can't say that about you, because you've really aged. You know that moment, and you think, I can't lie, but I can't be rude. And what do you say? Oh, no, I've dug myself in a hole already. So I said, I've lost a lot of hair up here. I've got older. And she looks at me and goes, "Well, solar panels for a love machine then." And I'm like, oh, my goodness, Mrs. Philp, you can't say things like that. Completely blew me away. And it was like one of those moments where you go, is this really you? Can this be you, Mrs. Philp? Someone's taken you over. Anyway, so that's a bit like what's going on here. In Ruth. I probably shouldn't have told that story, should I? No, all right. Okay. We're going to have to edit the tape before Lance listens to this thing. What I'm trying to communicate, ineptly, as always, is this. Naomi has changed lots. They hardly do recognise her. She's been worn down and crushed. This young woman who went away, a bride with her couple of young lads, with her husband, has now returned broken, crushed, clearly aged, the weight of the world upon her shoulders. And there's a little Hebrew wordplay here, of course, with the names. Remember, defined the names earlier. They say to her, "Is that you, Naomi?" In other words, "Is that you, pleasant one?" And she says, "No, I'm bitter, not pleasant, because God has afflicted me." That's literally what her response is, as she uses the name. She changed the name from Naomi to Mara, and Mara means bitter one. And of course, that sounds really bad. It sounds worse than it was actually meant. She does use a specific name of God. Your footnotes of your Bible might actually say this in verse 20. She says, "Don't call me Naomi, pleasant one. Call me Mara, bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." The word for Almighty she uses is El Shaddai, which is actually a specific name of God, which refers to God's dealings with individuals when they're in a time of trial. So actually, she's not denouncing God, but she's saying, "I've gone through some tough times, and God's taken me, he's dealt with me in these places of trials, and he's made my life bitter." And what she's telling us is this. She's saying, God is totally in charge. He's totally in charge, and I'm submitted to him. And, everything is out of his control and his permission. So it's she has a high sense of the sovereignty of God. And yet she's also being honest and saying, I feel like I've lost absolutely everything. I feel like that God has taken me through this horrendous ordeal and experience. And he just must be so displeased with me for allowing such misfortune to come into my life. What I love about the Bible, one of the main things I love about the Bible, is you see characters in there being really honest about God and about how they feel. You know, you don't have to pretend with God. You don't have to dress all up. We're invited to follow suit and to be brutally honest with God. He's a big God. He can take it, okay? And a part of the process of learning to deal with these things and to bring resolution is actually being honest about it as well. Now, of course, inevitably, like you and me, even when we do acknowledge the sovereignty of God, even when we're honest with God, like Naomi, we also ignore things. And Naomi ignored lots of things in that statement. She ignores the fact that it was her choice to leave. She and Elimelech chose to leave Bethlehem. She ignores the fact that she's alive when she could easily have been killed or died along the journey. She ignores the fact that she's back home safely and she's got friends waiting for her. She ignores the fact that God's given her an incredible daughter-in-law. She ignores the fact that the famine is over. Three things to pick up at this point. As we go on in the story, we're going to see that Naomi is not bitter. It's her life that God has made bitter. And that's what she means here. She's experienced many hard knocks, but she's not become over-hardened by them. And that's an important distinction for us to make ourselves. She's experienced bitter stuff, but she's not become bitter. Secondly, we see God is a big God, and Naomi is free to articulate her feelings there. No one feels they have to jump in as God's defense attorney to defend God's reputation. They actually have the wisdom to allow her to express what she's feeling. And again, that's something we can take on board. And then thirdly, she's very clear that God is the grounds of all her existence. Whether good or bad, he's her only hope. As her great-great-grandson would go on to write, "I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. My soul waits for the Lord." So we end this chapter with the women safely back in Bethlehem, where now there is bread in the house, and the story is set up for us. And we're at the start of the barley harvest, which actually takes place about now. It's the end of April, early May time. If this was a screenplay at this point, a voiceover would come on and it would say, "Tune in next time, 2 weeks' time, to hear the next instalment in the Book of Ruth." And you can do that, but I'd encourage you to read ahead as well to see what actually happens. But I want to leave you today out of this chapter with a couple of takeaway thoughts and reflections for us to go with into this week. And I think they really circle around the issue of choice and decision making. This week, how will you make your choices? To unpack that a bit more, are you going to be like Naomi? Maybe you resonate with Naomi. You're in bitter circumstances. There's stuff that's going on or has gone on which has a bitter, nasty taste in your life. And it's not resolved yet. So will you follow the example of Naomi and be honest in those bitter circumstances, but not allow yourself to become bitter in your spirit? And like Naomi, will you find a context where you can process that, people you can talk with about that, be accountable to, receive their love and their support, but also their challenge as well, and a bit of godly direction? That's the first bit of choice. So if you resonate with Naomi, are you going to follow her example as you deal with the bitter stuff of life? If you resonate with Ruth, one of the things she wrestled with and made a choice on was very simply, which God will she serve? And then, which community of faith will she walk that decision out in? And the question of which God we serve works at several levels. Obviously, there's the obvious level, which is, if you're not yet a follower of God, of Jesus, what's it going to take for you to make that decision, to commit to following him? You know, really wholeheartedly. Following the example of Ruth and going, I'm in this full-blooded, forever, permanently, whatever the cost. Even if the path right now doesn't look comfortable, I'm going to go for it. But also, some of you have already made that commitment. There are other false gods all around us in different parts of the land who claim our attention. The god of Penn Square Mall. The god of money. The god of sex. The god of whatever it is in your life, the issue is. God of power in the workplace. And these false gods are all around us in the land. And you'll be able to take that analogy and run with it. But which God are you going to serve this week when you have those choices to make? Which God are you going to serve? And which is the community you're going to walk with that's going to help you make those choices and live them out? Who is it you're going to process that stuff with? And never underestimate the impact which your decisions can have. Ruth was an insignificant woman at the bottom of the social pile. She had made two very big mistakes. One was she was a foreigner, and secondly, she was a woman. Very foolish thing to do at that time, obviously. And yet her impact echoes on 3,100 years later. One Bible commentator I read this week, here's a little quote, just a sentence, but it's a good quote. This person said this: the book of Ruth has the audacity to suggest that a single act of heroic love on the part of an insignificant alien widow was the key to the whole of Israel's future blessing. A single act of heroic love was the key for all of the future blessing that Israel, and indeed we, receive today. We'll explain more why that was the case as we go through the book. I don't want to jump ahead too far. And so my question for some of you this week is this: will you make an audacious choice to trust God this week? Will you have the audacity to say, God, I totally trust you in this situation? You know, we said at the beginning, the definition of a judge is someone who's a spiritual hero. Well, Ruth genuinely was a judge in that sense. She's a spiritual hero for us to copy and to learn from. But looking at her, who'd have known at this point? No one would have known. And you know what? You may feel, I'm insignificant, I can't make a difference. But it might be, as I stand here looking around this room, I'm looking at some people who are going to be genuine spiritual heroes to generations to come. It's kind of cool, that thought, isn't it? There might be people in here who, in 100 years' time, people are preaching about and writing books about. How interesting. Ooh, wonder who it'll be. It's exciting. I'd love to find out. But you can have that kind of impact. You can have that influence by honouring God and just making wise, godly decisions as you go through life. But as I finish, let me remind you of this. For both these women, there was a cost involved. And it was a cost they recognised and they embraced. You know, there's a principle when it comes to decision making, which is this: when you are at the crossroads of your life, that is where you find the cross. There is a going to the cross that's involved in choosing to commit to God and to follow him wholeheartedly. Because at the cross, it's a place of submission, of brokenness, of laying down your agenda and your preferences and your dreams and your desires and truly allowing God to use you as he wishes. Now, often he's very generous and he comes back into those dreams and visions and hopes and aspirations and multiplies them far more than you could ever have done under your own steam. So he's not a cruel God, but at the same time, his number one agenda is our hearts being locked onto him and being wholehearted for him. You know, being a woman of God or a man of God is sometimes a complete joy. It's wonderful. Other times, it can feel like a complete nightmare. But let's choose this week to allow God, if we're in the more latter group, to allow him to challenge us, to stretch us, trust in it. He will take us way beyond anything we could do under our own steam, and we really can become heroes of the faith, heroines of the faith, and make a massive difference wherever we go. So should we pray for that now? Okay. Why don't we stand together? Because you've been sitting for ages. You've probably got